Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Boys are diagnosed with autism 4.5 times as much as girls every year. But a growing body of research suggests that autism is far more prevalent among girls than previously thought. Health and science journalist Emily Sohn wrote about the issue for Spectrum. That's an online magazine that covers autism issues and research. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Emily Sohn.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The gender gap in autism, when did it start to appear? How long has this been going on?
I think it's been going on since autism diagnoses were, kind of created. But I'd say in the last 5 years or so, there's been this real explosion of interest and recognition that we're missing autism in girls, that they're diagnosed less, they're diagnosed later in life, and they're often either misdiagnosed or diagnosed with other, given other diagnoses that might distract or complicate the autism diagnosis.
Does this go back to the guidelines that diagnosticians use in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a long entrenched history here where autism was originally and primarily studied in white middle-class boys, and so that's where the definition lies. That's what screening and diagnostic tools are created to find, is sort of this profile-specific demographic, and so they just continue to get missed and not detected by some of those tools.
So I said that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that autism is diagnosed in boys 4.5 times as often as girls. What is the gap? I mean, are there raw numbers available that can tell us how many girls are out there versus how many boys that have been diagnosed?
You know, I don't know the exact numbers, but that statistic is so often repeated that when you look in the research literature, it's often stated in the very top of the introduction that as a fact that autism is 4 times more common in boys than in girls, and therefore in our study we have included 4 times more boys than girls.
It's self-perpetuating.
It really is a feedback loop where these studies, I think the average is there's 3 to 6 boys for every girl in the vast majority of studies, and some studies are up to 15 to 1. And, not only that, they don't actually separate the data on boys and girls. And often the numbers are so small that even if you have a ratio of 3 or 4 to 1, you have so few girls that you can't really detect any meaningful differences in the data between those two groups.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. There is a gender imbalance in the number of boys versus girls who are diagnosed with something along the spectrum of autism. My guest is Emily Sohn. She's a health and science journalist, and she wrote an article about it for Spectrum. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to have some experts on with us. We're going to talk more about this gender gap. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. What spurred your coverage of this topic, Emily Sohn?
Well, what we were really interested in was following up on a lot of this coverage that's been coming out for the last few years that's kind of flagging, okay, there are all these girls with autism who are getting missed. And that's kind of out there. But the next step is, how is that trickling down into the research literature? Because as we were just talking about, what really happens is, you're missing the girls, and then they're not getting included in the studies. And then you're then continuing to miss the girls because you're not detecting what the behavioral or brain or other differences might be. So I really wanted to dig into kind of what are the effects on science by our sort of continuing disparity there in diagnosis. And then specifically, what are scientists doing to do better to include more diverse voices?
And the bottom line is, you can't use the same guidelines for girls and boys because they present differently, right?
I mean, that's kind of what it's starting to look like. It's still a work in progress. Mm-hmm. And I think one real problem here is that not all boys are the same and not all girls are
right,
the same.
Of course.
But what it's starting to look like is there are some differences. What was really interesting to me was to learn about this, what's called camouflaging, where girls really learn how to kind of mask their autism symptoms. And so they practice in the mirror doing gestures or using specific types of language. They, you know, one researcher told me about a girl that she evaluated who came in and played with dolls, and the dolls were jumping up and down and playing out stories, and it was very imaginative and different voices for each doll. And she came out to talk to the mom, and the mom said, "Oh yeah, she learned that on YouTube." And the point was that she had really studied, what does this play look like and how can I get people to play with me? And she had learned that doing that worked. But it would have taken subsequent follow-ups and more evaluations to see that, okay, the next time she came in, she might do that exact same scenario.
It's so interesting.
A boy might not do the same thing.
Right. Girls are more there, that something, well, we don't really know because they're just starting the research, but how girls want to blend in more with society, and the boys tend not to have that same impulse.
It seems like there's a more interest in understanding relationships and social dynamics, and even recognizing that they aren't quite getting it like on their own, and so they need to learn how to do it. There was one, I talked with Kevin Pelfrey, who is a leader in the field, and he was talking about what he calls kind of girls on the edge. So they're not getting diagnoses, but they're showing a lot of features of autism. And he was sort of saying the typical presentation that he sees is, like a girl who will have a really intense interest in, say, Disney characters, and she'll know all the relationships between all the characters and have this vast knowledge about how they interact with each other. And she's really interested in socially interacting, but she might be slightly awkward. And it's a really different kind of presentation than, say, a typical picture of a boy who's obsessed with trains or something it's not a social interest. So there are these really subtle differences that are really interesting that I think that researchers are starting to dig into and try to understand.
Well, yeah, it's like payday for the researchers. Now they have this whole other gender to deal with.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's not just girls. I mean, there's also a growing awareness that there's a lot of people who identify as non-binary who are also who are autistic and who are maybe going undiagnosed or misdiagnosed for many years, that there's, our focus on the white male has really deprived science of understanding what's going on.
Lots of things, and not the least of which autism. Does the fact that we now see it as a spectrum change the equation on all of this, too?
So, I mean, I think that goes back to this girls on the edge. And mm-hmm. Pelfrey was also talking about boys on the edge. It's not just, we're almost constrained by the language that we have, that definitions we've created, that when you look at this specific set of criteria that have been set up based on boys, you're really constraining the problem and only looking at, the kids and adults with who are in that overlapping area who all fit that specific set of criteria, but that there's many different ways that people, might act or seem and still be autistic. We need to be better about detecting and understanding that.
I think it's interesting that you opened your article referring to a 42-year-old woman, Sharon Devanport, who wasn't diagnosed with autism until after her child was.
Yeah, that's something I came up that came up again and again.
Yeah.
And people I talked with, and just the forums that I was reading through, that for women in particular, it seems like there's this really common experience of going through life and maybe having struggles and being diagnosed with depression or anxiety or OCD or eating disorder, and not really benefiting from the traditional therapies for those. And then having kids, and then the kids get diagnosed because there's a whole growing awareness.
It tends to be a boy, by the way, but yeah.
Right, boy, and sometimes girls too. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, and two of the women I talked with, it was like the the child's neurologist or pediatrician looked at them and said, you know, have you thought about being screened as well? And it came as both a surprise at first and then somewhat of a relief to kind of understand themselves and to be able to put some of their own life experiences into context. It was a real process of self-discovery in their 30s.
Exactly. I'm wondering what the ramifications are of such a late diagnosis versus had she been diagnosed, age appropriate, like most kids are when they're coming into 2, 3, 4, 5 years old and their behaviors start to diverge. And I'm wondering, has anyone talked about what those ramifications are?
Yeah, I talked at length with a couple of women who had a lot of really thoughtful and sometimes surprising reflections to share. And it was mixed. They felt a little bit like a sense of relief, like, oh, this explains so much. Mm-hmm. And now I can move forward and find a community of people who understand my experience and can offer that support. But they also, you know, there was a mixed reflection about what I have wanted to know earlier. And one woman said to me, you know, looking at my kid who's been recommended for 40 hours of services a week, I'm not sure I would have wanted that, you know, that she was sort of saying, I got to live my life and go to school, and that was a good thing for her. So, you know, it's like, it's a lot to grapple with, I think.
The ones that fall through the cracks and later are diagnosed as adults, do they tend to be pretty high functioning, I would assume, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think people like that who had jobs and they have families, mm-hmm. and, you know, for them, it's like, it's more, you know, finding their, a couple of you will use the word tribe, you know, finding their tribe or finding their community, a sense of understanding, you know, that we all want, like, here's a community of my, you know, your people who get you. And so that, I think, was a really important journey for them to find that.
You wrote about a challenge to recruiting women and girls into autism studies, is that they tend to accumulate misdiagnoses or additional diagnoses. What was mm-hmm. that about?
It's really common, and I think more common in girls than in boys, to accumulate additional diagnoses, like especially depression, anxiety, OCD, eating disorders. And I think scientists are still trying to work that out, but it's a really important observation to note, because what researchers are looking into is whether they can kind of take those co-diagnoses as a way forward. So, for example, William Mandies, a researcher in the UK, has done some surveys and found that in eating disorder clinics, up to 20% of girls and women have undiagnosed autism, which is really important, because the way that eating disorder clinics function is often there will be kind of group meal times and therapy sessions, and a lot of times that doesn't work for an autistic woman who might, you know, for example, Sharon, who I talked with, she had been told as a teenager that she had anorexia, and it kind of blindsided her, because she wasn't eating because she was really sensitive to the textures of the foods and the smells, and they made her gag. And so it wasn't that, you know, she wanted to gain weight, and she knew she was skinny. She wasn't obsessed with losing weight. Mm-hmm. She just was having trouble with textures and smells of food. And so if she's in a clinic where they're telling her you need to eat all that before you can move on and do something else, or that's really not going to work for her. It's not acknowledging what the underlying issue is for her. And there was another example of a woman who, you know, the lights were really bright in the therapist's room, and she asked if he could dim the lights. She was really sensitive to that, and he told her, no, you're just trying to manipulate me to, you know, turn down the lights. And so she's not benefiting from these efforts to help her, because they're not recognizing what's really going on.
Well, Emily Sohn, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your insights, and we'll have a link to your article on our website at wosu.org. Thanks again.
I appreciate that. I'm glad you're talking about this. Thanks.
Emily Sohn is a health and science journalist. She wrote an article about the gender gap in autism diagnoses for Spectrum. We'll have a link to that, as I said, at WOSU.org/allsides. More coming up on this topic, on the gender gap. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the gender gap in autism and why it matters. The Centers for Disease Control reports the disorder is 4.5 times more common among boys than girls. But a growing body of research suggests that may not reflect reality. It may be that they're 4.5 times more likely to be diagnosed with autism, but that doesn't mean that there are 4.5 times as many. Jacqueline Nguyen is the director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital. She joins us. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Valerie Paradis is the vice president of services and supports for Autism Speaks. That's an autism advocacy organization based in New York City. She is a person with autism and is a parent of an adult son on the spectrum. Valerie joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be joining you.
Valerie Paradis, tell us how your case was first diagnosed. What happened?
Sure. Well, I am one of those individuals who was diagnosed late in life. I was 40 years old when I was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. And this came quite a few years after my own son's diagnosis. He was diagnosed at age 3. And as I was raising him as a single mom, I began to inform myself about autism. And together we became involved in the fledgling disability movement right at that time for autistic people. And many of my friends were people on the spectrum, and with time, they basically did an intervention with me and said, Val, you need to go get yourself evaluated and diagnosed. So that's really sort of in a nutshell what happened, and it's been a very rich, rich time in my life since my diagnosis and getting the supports that I need to live a more fulfilling life.
Yeah, that's the rub, is are girls getting as many supports as the boys are? And I want to get to that. But first, Jacqueline Nguyen, how does a diagnosis work? It's not like a blood test. How do you do that?
Right. You have to really take some time. And so the process is really a lot of talking and interviewing families about the child. In our case, we're at a children's hospital. It can happen later, too. But for the child's everyday functioning, what's going wrong, what's of concern, and also looking back in time, too. So if a family comes to us and their child is 12, we really need to be looking back at what happened at age 2, 3, and 4, because it could be quite different. And that's where you might get a lot of the clues, because some of the symptoms might have dissipated or changed a bit. And I think what is happening related to diagnosing girls is that we're not identifying when some of the main criteria that we're looking at, the social functioning, when it's presenting a bit differently, we need to be catching up a bit on what kinds of questions are we asking? What do we really need to be looking for?
Right. How might the diagnoses process change when you start to consider the fact that there so many of these girls are falling through the cracks. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're obviously not you, but I mean, the diagnosticians aren't asking the right questions.
Right. Well, I think it's something really to start to unfurl. I mean, I've been doing this about 30 years.
Yeah.
The 1 in 4 ratio has not changed. You know, obviously our prevalence has hugely, hugely changed. But so there probably still could be some genetic underpinning that's still going to have a difference. And what I think we might need to be looking for is at the edges. So for higher functioning girls, for girls that aren't presenting in that kind of standard profile where the social deficits are very apparent and the repetitive and ritualistic behaviors are very apparent, what are we asking about to clarify the edges of those symptom areas?
Does the idea of a spectrum instead of a black and white diagnosis change that equation?
Well, I think so. So we're now in the understanding that this disorder is a
continuum.
Yes,
it's along a continuum.
And there are many what we call phenotypes or types. The way the disorder looks is there are multiple versions of it,
right.
And they're all now we're looking at kind of collapsing them all into one umbrella, but understanding that it's going to look different. And so what we need to have are enough examples of the different traits that still fit the child or the individual into this category of disability. And so so this could become one of the topics and one of the new research areas that helps broaden out what are those symptoms that we're counting to fit into the category of a social deficit.
Valerie Paradis, what was the diagnostic process for you? What did it feel like as an adult woman with a child? I mean,
yeah, well, it was a very challenging time in my life. Not only because I was a single mother of a child on the spectrum, but just the fact that I was really challenged my entire adult life to that point in two arenas, one in employment and the other in relationships. And this is quite common for many of us on the spectrum. And so I actually was in a moment of crisis when in my own work I had been I had been a professor of German literature, teaching at Bard College in upstate New York, and really not making all of the connections I needed to make in order to achieve tenure. I did not really know you have to build political relationships and have allies in order to achieve tenure. And I was very good at doing research. I was very good at publishing in my field, but I wasn't really good at making those network choices among colleagues. And really, most of the people I interacted with and preferred to interact with were my students because they were younger than me, and that was just an easier method of really connecting with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't advancing in my career. And then I started a school for children with autism in middle and high school, really out of necessity because of my son's own crisis in school that he was having. And suddenly I was in a managerial position directing the school and had to communicate with staff, collaborate with a partner school district that our nonprofit was partnering with to develop this program. And I was in a crisis in my work at that time, again, because I wasn't really aware of just how impactful the social differences that I experience are day to day. And so what I ended up doing, like I said, some of my best friends still are my dearest friends on the spectrum, stepped in and said, Val, you need to go get evaluated so that you know if you're on the spectrum. I didn't feel like I needed to be diagnosed. I was one of those women, and as a younger person, one of those girls on the fringes that we were speaking about before. And at the same time, felt it was necessary to do so. And so I did go to NYU Hospital. I participated in a study that was going on there at the time and was diagnosed, again, at age 40. But once I was diagnosed, like I said, I was also able to access more targeted support in therapy and also in sensory integration supports that have been life-changing for me.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Valerie Paradis. She's Vice President of Services and Supports for Autism Speaks, an autism advocacy organization based in New York City. We're talking with her today because we're talking about the gender imbalance and diagnoses of autism spectrum disorder. My other guest is Jacqueline Wynn. She's Director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital. If you have a question or comment about the gender imbalance that we're talking about, give us a call. Are you a woman who slipped through the cracks and as an adult was diagnosed with autism or with a disorder on the spectrum? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We know that it's still one in four, Jacqueline Wynn, as you said. How are you changing what you do right now, bearing this in mind now, that someone like Valerie Paradis slips through the cracks for all those years?
Right. Well, I think, one of our obligations when we're working with families is to be taking as much care as possible. We're spending lots of time talking, but we still have to acknowledge that we're coming to that conversation with potentially a bias as to what we think autism looks like. And I think this new discussion is bringing that forward. And, psychologists are responsible to be adjusting their perspectives based on these kinds of discussions. So the research really has to catch up a little bit. Like we really want to use evidence-based information,
right,
to say these are the additional, features that would need to be evaluated if the child is a girl. These would be the additional versions of a social deficit that we shouldn't be discounting and saying that's outside the range, that's still, because it has an underpinning of a lack of understanding of the social engagement. So, sometimes girls can appear to be shy, or just there's an anxiety component to the social engagement, and then it gets discounted as being a different kind of issue. But if there's an underpinning of not understanding, not knowing how, we need the girls to be able to admit that, because some of the masking and camouflaging is about, putting forth a good effort.
They don't want anybody to know.
Right, to fit in. And what, we've been working with girls. We do a girls group at Children's. So we just had a younger girls group, 10 to 12-year-olds. And the amount of conversation they had about their awareness of being different, and the pressure to fit in, the pressure to be cheerful,
uh-huh,
and engaging, how many times have we walked down the hall and someone says, smile, because
yeah,
we're a woman, right?
Right.
So that's hitting 10-year-olds. So for our girls, sometimes with our boys, we think there's a bit of a protective factor that they have some social deficit, a little bit of social isolation, but there's a little period in early adolescence or pre-adolescence where they're not quite aware of that. But I think our girls are aware of it because of the increased social capabilities that we think, our hypothesis is that the girls were missing.
Endemic in girls.
Yes. And
yeah.
Yeah. So we already have a gender difference in terms of social functioning between boys and girls.
Right.
Why wouldn't we also have that gender difference in autism? And
right,
are we not accounting for that when we ask the kinds of questions we need to ask?
We've got some calls coming in and I'm going to get to those. But Valerie Paradis, what were some of the things you did as a girl?
Yeah.
In looking back now, you realized you were sort of bending over backwards to do something that didn't feel natural to fit in.
Yes, I really appreciate what Jacqueline just had to say. And, I felt like I was going down the checklist for myself as she was mentioning many of those things. One thing, I did have severe social anxiety. To the point, I do remember in second grade almost never, ever speaking in school, just out of fear of making some sort of social mistake. And it was a very painful year that year for me in school, extremely memorable. I also, as I got a little older and was moving into the teenage years, I grew up in Southern Colorado. And it was sort of the high desert where I lived. And after high school, sometimes and quite frequently during, I remember very much during my junior year, just going out for long walks out in the prairie or the desert after school. And actually repeating over and over again sort of things that were said to me by other girls and friends, and then repeating back to myself what I replied with to them, and just really almost you know, hyper vigilant about reviewing what I had said, what I had heard, wow. And wondering, you know, with great anxiety, had I said the wrong thing? And you know, the other point that Jacqueline made about, you know, the camouflaging and the masking, that is a very, very real experience for many of us who are females on the spectrum. And you know, sometimes it's not even a choice. It's sort of like you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. And so you may be really going to great lengths to mask and camouflage because that's all you've really known what to do to kind of cope, right?
Did you, I mean, you wonder, and I think lots of kids feel this way from time to time. I don't know, but like feeling like, does everybody else get it? And I don't. did you ever assume that there might be other girls out there struggling with the same things, trying to fit in, but you just can't talk to them about it?
Well, I knew about other girls who I didn't have that feeling of potential failure socially with at any moment. It could happen, right?
Uh-huh.
And those girls were usually, you know, similar to my profile. They were nerdy. I was a straight A student. That had its upsides and downsides because all I did was study and learn, almost as a way to self-impose some structure in my day-to-day and kind of avoid friendships. Because like mastery over, you know, certain subject areas or topics is something that many of us on the spectrum share. You know, wanting that kind of input, but it's also a way to structure the day and try to eliminate sort of the unknowns of the social world, which is like a moving target all day long, right? And so the other girls who became friends and then later in college, just really those were my friends, were the very studious, nerdy girls who, you know, wanted to talk about, you know, the prepositions in the Russian language, you know, and how they compare to prepositions in the French language, as opposed to, you know, there's a party over, there's a party at this sorority tonight, right? So that's really, you know, the difference in those friendships was just, it was a level of trust and just really, truly, I guess, letting your mask down as opposed to letting your hair down.
Yeah. Well, Valerie Paradis, she's Vice President of Services and Supports for Autism Speaks, and she also is a person with autism. You just heard from her, and also with us, Jacqueline Nguyen. She's Director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital. We do have some calls. I'm going to get to them when we return. We're talking about the gender imbalance in autism diagnoses in the United States. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the gender gap in autism and why it matters. The Centers for Disease Control reports the disorder is 4.5 times more common among boys than girls, but a growing body of research suggests that that may not reflect reality. Still with us is the director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital, Jacqueline Nguyen, and by phone, Vice President of Services and Supports for Autism Speaks in New York City, Valerie Paradis. Valerie also has a child with autism and also has been diagnosed herself. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jacqueline, before I turn to the callers, What do we know about what efforts are being made in the research community to get at this issue?
Well, it is a growing area of interest. And so I think there's some basic research being done to just look at are there identifiers that help us know what are the social differences. There's nice eye tracking data, and there's nice analyses of different kind of social engagements that girls are having with who have autism that the boys don't have. But I think research takes so long. You know, it's 10 years before you have a big question. Everyone gets to work. You have to get funding. You have to do the study. So it'll be a little while before we have definitive answers that change our practice day to day. But the good thing in treatment is that you can look at the individual child in front of you and be working on whatever that particular child needs. So when we have girls come to us and they have more subtle or different kinds of social needs, we can already go ahead and intervene in a way that's individualized.
And are parents playing a role in any of this, less likely to bring a girl in for evaluation than they might a boy because of the same kind of social norms we put on them?
That's a great question. I will take that question back, but not looking at referral rates versus the outcome of the diagnostic process.
It's a lot more boys.
The outcome is a lot more, but I don't know if at the beginning of the process, whether there's already a difference, whether parents are not having as many concerns for girls. I would imagine there's some split, but it'd be a good thing to evaluate.
And Valerie Paradis, any sense about that? Whether, your parents didn't see it either, and that's why they didn't have you evaluated?
Yeah, that's
you're successful
sure
in
place.
School and you had some friends and
I was yes, exactly. And also I grew up in a big family with three sisters and two brothers and I shared the bathroom with my sisters in the morning getting ready for school each day, and while they were putting on their makeup and talking about boys, I would kind of sneak in there and just try to get my teeth brushed, and felt that, everything they were talking about was just sort of silly. And at the same time, they were my social coaches, my sisters, and I'm forever grateful to them for that, that they pushed me in ways that were uncomfortable, but in other ways I was exposed, to sort of what girls often do. and I know in our culture today, a lot of that shifting, with our LGBTQ friends and transgender awareness. But at the same time, it was very, very helpful to me in terms of learning, social sort of cues and ways to be with my girlfriends at school.
Julia in Lancaster, you're on the air. Hi, Julia.
Hi. So I feel like I am being described, and I wondered how an adult might go ahead and get diagnosed as autistic or on the spectrum.
Are you doing okay, Julia?
I'm a little emotional.
Yeah. Well, you feel like you're being described. I mean, it's got to be. Jacqueline, what do you recommend?
Well, I'm glad Julia's called because I think, one of the beauties of that process that you go through is to have an explanation for some of the challenges that you've had. And that can allow you to kind of put that set of questions and close that door and then move on to the next set of things. How can I work on these things? So I think the first thing I would do is just talk to your physician. That's a good place to start. And then I think psychologists in the region can start that process for you. So it usually starts with a physician making a referral. At Ohio State, there is the Nisonger Center, and they have all kinds of different programs for assessing disability, and they have services for adults with disability and autism. So that might be another place to just jump ahead and call directly.
And Valerie Paradis, tell Julia what you think.
Well, one thing you can also do is reach out to other women on the spectrum of autism to learn more. And one organization that does just this is the Autistic Women and Non-Binary Network. And so it may be something you want to look into, even just to visit their website and see if, if more that you read there is familiar to you and feels like something you want to look into further for yourself.
Yeah.
And thank you for calling. I'm glad that you did. You're welcome here.
Julia, thank you for your call. Are you feeling okay?
Yeah, it's nice to get confirmation that I wasn't just the weird kid.
Exactly. Well, you know, keep us posted, okay?
Yes.
All right.
Yes, thank you.
Take care.
Yes.
Jen in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Jen.
Hello. I feel like your previous caller was me about 5 years ago being diagnosed with ADD inattentive. I was the weird, quirky kid who always tried to figure out how to behave like everybody else. And by the time I got to high school, I kind of had it. But under times of stress was when the facade would kind of drop.
Hmm.
Right now, we are going through something similar with my daughter, who just started high school this year. And she's always been very shy, very timid, and she's always wanted to be the kid in the back of the class that observes everybody else, doesn't want to speak in class, but does a wonderful job writing everything down. One thing I wanted to point out is that I think that what we know about the autism spectrum is so, I think that most of us don't know at all. My youngest son was diagnosed with ADHD, just this year we had him evaluated for autism, and it took me 3 or 4 years to be willing to even have him tested because I was like, well, no, he's engaging. He makes eye contact. This is not the problem. But how it presents in him is that he will he'll have some sort of solitary experience where it's watching a TV show or playing a video game or something. Mm-hmm. And then when he's done doing that, it's like a data dump. So he comes to you and it's like somebody describing a long dream. Like it's like, okay, I am not familiar with this, you know, you need to, so I've been trying to work with him on, you know, bullet points, you know, can you summarize it so that I can pay attention the entire time you're trying to tell me? Because again, I have ADD inattentive. So like with my ADD inattentive, I mean, it's his long story. They don't always mesh well. But with my daughter, it's very interesting. When I brought up to her therapist that I wanted her tested for autism, the therapist kind of looked at me like, well, I don't see this. But what she doesn't see is when my daughter gets home from school, how exhausted she is trying to behave just like everybody else.
Yeah.
And one thing that really improved things recently was my taking her iPhone away at 10 p.m. every night. Because she was watching so much YouTube and watching it and I think kind of masking.
Well, I want to ask Valerie Paradis if that exhaustion issue rings a bell with you, Valerie.
Oh, absolutely. And it still does today, you know, after long days at work that have, you know, many more interactions involved with coworkers than I really have to plan. Two things. One, to just be really quiet and not have interactions with other people, you know, pretty much the rest of the day. And also other ways to manage, you know, the fatigue and the stress from that is I need a lot of sensory input. So I exercise like the Dickens, and it's really, you know, meant to kind of reduce all of that buildup across the day, for sure.
Jen in Dublin, thanks for your call. I want to get to one more call before we move on. Sheila in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. I'm calling because I feel like I had an interesting experience in getting my daughter diagnosed. She is 2.5, and she's a twin. So for us, not knowing what autism really was, it was easy to have that control group at our own home.
Right, you have two,
So we could observe what one twin was doing, and then we could start to pick up on those social cues and things that my daughter with autism wasn't doing, and that's how she got diagnosed so early at age two. But also I was kind of excited to provide, you know, information for research because I felt like it was an interesting scenario that we had at home, but didn't encounter a lot of opportunity to help research for girls with autism.
Right. It's a fledgling field now as far as looking into girls with autism. Jacqueline Nguyen, do you have any recommendations for someone like Sheila who's trying to help out?
Well, I think there are some national registries and genetic studies that are happening where genetic samples can be gathered actually at Nationwide Children's. We're a part of some of those that we think will contribute to lots of different kinds of research in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have genetic information about all kinds of kids with autism, then researchers can take a subset of those kids who have a certain kind of profile. Being female could be one of them.
Twins.
Yeah, twins. And then do some other kinds of basic research or look at outcomes or things like that. So that's one way when there's not an actual ongoing study available to join in right now, that's a way to help.
Okay. Sheila, thanks a lot for that call. Valerie Paradis, what about you? What do you tell people who are asking those kinds of questions from where you sit at Services and Supports for Autism Speaks?
Asking questions about participating in research,
right,
or more about what we provide through our services.
Well, that's a good question too. Is how does this change? What's available for girls and women if the diagnostics aren't caught up yet? Then what about services? Might
exactly.
they be different too?
That's right. Well, one thing that we do provide at Autism Speaks is our autism response team, which is basically our call center, which you can reach us by email or by phone. And we have a network of associates nationwide who can speak either to family members or to individuals on the spectrum directly to not only locate resources directly in their region or their area, but also just talk through any kinds of challenges or even opportunities that, you know, someone may need support with in just navigating and finding the right kind of resources to guide them through that. And obviously, you know, we get a lot of calls from everyone across the spectrum, as well as all expressions of autism. But women and girls, you know, it's another frequent sort of stream of callers and people who contact us. So there are some more specific resources there that we can provide.
You know, I don't know about you guys, but Julia really touched my heartstrings there. I mean, someone, it's like, you know, you think of someone who's living with this for a long time that doesn't know or understand, like you, Valerie. I mean,
yes.
You must have felt that.
Absolutely. And my heart goes out to her. And I also just really urge her to connect with others, professionals, and as well as other people on the spectrum, especially when we're adults. You know, that's a really lovely way to get to learn more about ourselves if we feel we're on the spectrum. I mean, my very good friends with autism did that for me, you know, several years ago. And really there's a world out there waiting for Julia and others who may have those questions.
Well, Valerie Paradis, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Valerie Paradis is Vice President of Services and Supports for Autism Speaks. That's an autism advocacy organization based in New York City. We'll have a link to that website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Valerie Paradis also was diagnosed at the age of 40 with autism. Also, Jacqueline Nguyen, thanks for joining us again. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Jacqueline Nguyen is Director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Haley Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, our interns Ray Brewster, Sophie Warner, and Maisie Glockner. She produced this show today with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Annalyn DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter too at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.